this morning we have a very different subject than the one last week, or the last lecture, because we are going to explore a field where, for the most part, efforts have failed. We are trying to discover a little more about life. Not life as time, but life as energy. Life as vitality. Life as consciousness, will, wisdom, and action. And in order to understand these principles, we have to do something that is against present policy. We have to turn to the past. At this moment, the world is very conscious of the present and fearful of the future, where much of the problem rests has been ignored, and that is in the past. Now, the past is something more than dead yesterday, and to overlook it is to lose the most wonderful text for the study of our problems, because none of these problems are actually new. They are all part of the descent of a stream of life, and this stream of life is the thing we want to consider. Some years ago, General Furlong, in his Rivers of Life, gave us a chart showing the development of races, sub-races, and a great arterial system of life descending through history. Everything in this list and everything in this chart is actually very scientific, very factual, and probably more readable and usable than the histories that we write today. We are therefore interested in trying to understand something of the principle of life as we accept it, as we know it, as we live it, and as we pass out with no understanding of what it is, or very little understanding. Now, at the present time, there are two attitudes towards this subject. The first is materialistic and scientific. Now, the study of science in relationship to the vital, moral, and ethical development of races has been generally neglected. The modern scientist is interested in what he calls facts. And facts are to him the actual occurrences of today, the actual checking that he can make of things on the physical level. He does not really try to figure out why these things happen, but he is interested in how they happen. He does not know or recognize any particular reason for these happenings, except they occur as the effects of causes that are set in motion in our daily existence. The true and complete materialist does not believe we existed at any time except now. He does not believe in any of the theological doctrines of immortality. He does not recognize a religious principle behind physical phenomena. He is concerned typically with what he calls facts, and all of his facts are more or less physical. When the facts are not physical, he is very suspicious of them and would prefer to reject them entirely. Therefore, the scientist makes physical phenomena the fact of existence. Everything exists because of certain phenomena, and life itself is one of these tremendous energy factors with which he is concerned. He does not know where life comes from, except in the physical sense, through the perpetuation of species. He does not know about the overtones which affect the conduct of human beings, because to him these things are merely passing shadows on the surface of a scientific factuality with which he is completely absorbed. The result is that as far as moral and ethical development is concerned, the scientist has to depend upon another factor if he wishes to develop any of the overtones of ethics. he has to divide his attention and admit the existence of something above or beyond science. This he hesitates to do because he feels that the moment he passes from the fact, he passes into a mirage. All overtones to him are simply the longings of the human soul for something beyond the physical. And the scientist is very doubtful if there is anything beyond the physical worthy of consideration. Now, on the other side of this coin, we have the religious point of view. We have that of the individual who by nature believes in the reality of the wonderful. He believes that there are principles at work constantly, that life is not simply a drifting along through a mass of physical phenomena. Life is the unfolding of a plan, a purpose, that there is a divine power at the source of life. He has his problems trying to prove this, but also he has certain points that are worthy of consideration. To the theosophist or theologist, as the case may be, the physical phenomena of life is more than merely the unfoldment of bodies. Life is a stream of some kind, as shown by Furlong in his Rivers of Life. Life is an unfolding process going on constantly. It has passed through one cycle after another. It continues to move cyclically within the boundaries of law. Somewhere in this great pattern of motions, there is an ethics. There is a tremendous purpose. There is a valid reason. The theologist is not always sure what that reason is, but he believes in a divine power at the root of life, and that this divine power is the source of good, and that this divine power must be cultivated within his own life and the principles of it applied to society. Therefore, he has his point of view, but as far as the scientist is concerned, his point of view is scarcely adequate. The scientist says the theologian, in order to have the point of view that gives him hope and idealism, must ignore a vast order of physical phenomena. The theologian, on the other hand, says that to get down to the level of physical science, the scientist must ignore a mass of superphysical phenomena, which he cannot deny, which he cannot disprove, but he finds difficulty in accepting within the boundaries of science. Therefore, we have the scientist as a person actually moving in a physical environment. When he thinks of history, he thinks of physical history. When he thinks of the future, he thinks of a future of scientific historicity. He believes in the unfolding of forms, of the constant enlargement of human empire. He believes constantly that the human being is the master of all things in the material world, that the human being is the lord of all he surveys, that he is constantly being challenged, but the growth, progress, and unfoldment are the result of the pressures of human occupation and exercise, that the physical world is being built by material means, and that these material means are largely under the general supervision of the scientific concept. The perfectly scientific person, therefore, would be a perfectly lawful person. But he would live within a very narrow rule, a rule of materiality alone, because there's no place in his system for the immortality of the soul or the presence of a divine trinity at the basis or in the foundation of the material quaternary. Now, with these two points of view, we need history. We need to take something that is now being generally ignored. In fact, we are almost invited to ignore it. We must not think of the past. The moment we think of past, we become involved in morality. The moment we begin to examine the structure of human history, we become come into the presence of a tremendous ethical structure, a structure of moralities, a structure of laws, a structure of principles. Most of these have been set forth in the great religious histories and philosophies of mankind. Now, if we accept the reality of tradition, if we accept the fact that history is a valid instrument of knowledge, and it was one of the valid instruments of Lord Bacon in his Nova Morganum, or the new instrument of knowing. We then have to realize that in history, we have to study the concatenations of events in a way that we do not do at the present time. In other words, the average person is not interested in the law of cause and effect. He doesn't know why it functions. He only knows that it interferes largely with what he wants to do. And as he goes along his way, that which comes in conflict with his ambitions and his purposes is considered to be unreasonable or at least unpleasant. So that the person today tries to avoid the challenge of cause and effect. If he goes back into history, he will find 100 empires that fell from the same mistakes that he is making. Now, this should mean that history is a valid subject. History should be taught in schools because it is the story of what happens when we do certain things. And we have proof that these happenings are inevitable and immutable. They are just as scientific as anything advanced by science. But because they deal with moral, ethical, or spiritual values, science prefers to ignore them as not provable. Yet they are provable. History is what proves them. And until we can prove definitely that the developments of life on this planet survive against historical mistakes, we have to consider history as part of the story. Now, history tells us that there is a pattern by which all things in this world move, and what Furlong calls the rivers of life. In the Bible, four rivers rose out of Eden and made fruitful the earth. Rivers of ethics, rivers of morality, rivers of religion, religions of art and science. All these things are great institutional structures built upon the manifestation of history as ethics. So we look around and we see that certain things always happen. Now we come to a group of people who do not care whether they happen or not. One of the reasons being that they have never studied sufficiently the records of human action and activity to realize the importance of these things. The young person in school today is told that now we are living in the grand age of all things that are wonderful, and therefore the past is made up of a group of primitive wanderers struggling against the advancement of science. This is not true, but this is what the average person is inclined to believe. He is inclined to believe that now is important, that everything should be judged by now. We should judge the TV programs by now. And if we do that, we're in kind of difficult situation. And we must also beware that we must judge nuclear physics by now and by the building of more nuclear plants. We must judge the result of destruction of our environment by now. Everything must be today. And the reasons why we're in trouble are neatly evaded because they interfere with our good spirit in doing what we please regardless of consequences. So we begin to study what these things all add up to. Now, when it comes to this point in the view, we have now two systems. One believing that there is a principle of good, and the other believing primarily in a principle of skills or ethical, physical pursuits and progressions. Now, in this, we have to try to study something. Of course, in religion, deity emerges either as a person or as a principle who becomes or which becomes personalized. We consider deity as a supreme power of the source of life, and that this supreme power has the right and the power and the privilege to cause any series of consequences that are necessary for the fulfillment of its own purpose. Now, just what that purpose is not very clear. Whether this purpose is to prove the existence of deity or whether it is intended to result in the perfection of creation is a matter that's still open to considerable debate. For the general point of view is that the will of this power is the perfection of all that lives according to some code of perfection, which at the present time is largely physical. The perfection may call for something better than physical, but the reason for it is the conveniences of physical life, such as, for instance, the end of poverty, the end of crime, and the end of many vices that arise which are against the common good of society. So now we have a problem that goes right back to this concept of deity. Deity is supposed to have been the power that created the human being. Humanity is a projection of deity into manifestation. Why was this projection necessary? This is a question that is constantly under consideration. If we wish to assume that deity is all-powerful, omnipotent in every sense of the word, why did deity not produce its creation perfect to start with? After all, why should deity create an imperfect structure and then demand its perfection through a series of what to the average person consists of misfortunes? Where and how is it that humanity, being a product of the divine mind and the divine will and the divine soul, should not have been developed perfect in the beginning? Why should there be this tremendous struggle against the evils of life? Why should the individual be required to constantly stand against his natural inclinations? If he was intended to be perfect, why were these inclinations embodied into his structure? Why was he made imperfect if the divine power can produce perfection? Why should the individual be in constant conflict with morality and ethics if he is a principle has origin in a divine power that is perfect in morality and ethics? This question has been asked time and time again, and it seems to be one of the great hang-ups in the development of an ethical world principle. Why is man not perfect if he is the product of perfection? And if he is not the product of perfection, why does he hope for perfection if the only power that exists cannot bestow it or does not bestow it? Now, there has to be an answer to this. And the material scientists take it very simply. There is no such thing as a control demanding perfection. The human being is a growth, an unfoldment of physical forces and factors. Enfolded within it, this picture, this being, is life. Life, integration, and a power to grow, to become, and to propagate. These things are inherent in forms, but they do not contain within themselves any strict or certain form of ethics. They are growth producing right and wrong, and right and wrong are finally sorted out by the results of action. The individual who has enough experiences gradually comes to certain conclusions. This theory, however, has been subject to a number of reversals. At the present time, we have more intellectual knowledge than ever before and less ethics. We have developed a tremendous growth of materialism away from ethics, away from morality, and away from principles. Now, if the scientific process is complete, and the final end of all things is the production of a self-sustaining creature, a being that is sufficient of all its needs, then science is in trouble because it isn't producing such a creature. If, on the other hand, only morality and ethics, temptation, and gradual moral growth can produce perfection or produce release from problems, then why and how does this come through in our theological studies and considerations? So we come to a very interesting problem here. Namely, let us now say that we are going to think in terms of a different concept of what humanity is. We thought of humanity as a biological miracle on the physical level and a psychological miracle on the religious level. But perhaps there's something else to the thing. There's something more that we haven't investigated at all. And that is, what is the basic structure of life in this world? or any other created sphere of life. What is life in this sense? Now, the ancients had another concept of this, which we have generally overlooked. One of the oldest forms of symbolism for life is a river. It is a stream. And in most philosophies of antiquity, this stream of life is flowing out of a cause. It is like a stream rising in a great mountain and gradually drifting down the side of a hill, gathering small riplets to itself, until finally, with a tremendous crash, this stream of life falls into the sea. And this is the great cycle of life, that this is life moving inevitably towards infinite differentiation and finally into ultimate reorganization and reintegration. Therefore, instead of thinking of life as simply an energy in the sense of humanity, let us think of humanity as an aspect of life. That life itself is a forever ensouling power. It is continually unfolding itself. And this great stream of life, which we call humanity, is one tremendous entity, an entity which is, according to some of the Hindu philosophies, composed of nearly 60 billion single entities. That what we call humanity is a vast energy, a vast concept and complex of motion, life, integration, and power. That what we call the human being is a member of this great society which we call humanity. Humanity is one structure, one being, one substance. And this humanity rises within the unfolding of universal phenomena. It arises not in materialism, but in the great process of nature and nature's labors, namely, be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Therefore, we are thinking now not of humanity as a series of individuals alone, but humanity as the one being which we call the human being. We find this in the ancient religious systems of both Christianity and the ancient Hebrew systems from which the Old Testament was derived. We find, therefore, that there in the Old Testament, that Adam Kadmon, is not a person. Adam Kadmon is humanity collective. There is one mysterious power. This being is one being. And this one being consists of all individual human beings considered together and moving together in the great river of life. And this river of life is being moving to the perfection of itself. This is a little abstract and a little big to think about all at once, but it gives us a very important clue, namely that we are moving together along a pattern that is intended to bring about certain definite results. In other words, we are not paying for past sins, nor are we doomed to make more sins and nothing else. We are here to grow, to unfold the potential which we call human, which is one of the innumerable levels of life in the infinite universe. We are one creature, more or less, cast away like Robinson Crusoe on a desert island, but not cast away outside of the divine purpose. Cast away to prove and justify that purpose. We are here to achieve the growth of this being which we call humanity. This being is made up of an infinite number of separate personalities, all growing together. This great being which we call the humanity also breaks up within itself into a number of races, sub-races, and divisions, all of which are part of one structure. This one structure being a level of growth in the universe, a level that has become part of everything, just as much a justified fact as the development of solar systems, or the development of planets, or the development of various continents on planets. These things are growth symbols, and humanity is an entity growing. One entity, made up of an infinite variety of individualities, This was the point that was made by Herbert Spencer, that man is an infinite variety. And when we think of man, we think of mankind, not as a person, but as the person composed of all the individual members of the human life wave. Humanity becomes, therefore, a life wave, a life motion in space, a life principle with which we must all become more and more aware and properly informed. This mere one principle, therefore, is not here to be punished. It is here to grow. And the symbol of that growth is simply a child. A child is a symbolic unit in this great process. The child is not born to suffer. The child is not born to make mistakes. The child is here to learn through trial and error to develop the potential of itself. In other words, by growing, the individual overcomes the stasis which we call inertia. Everything in the solar system is growing. Races grow. Nations grow. Nations and races break up into subdivisions. They can pass through all forms of temptations and problems, such as a child growing up. And this child is not going to be stronger by having temptation removed, because this would be contrary to the production of a mature race, a race capable of taking its place among the great galaxies which populate space. So we are part of the population of space. We are part of a plan which we don't know the end of, and probably will not for a long time. But we know we are growing for a purpose, that this growth is proper, natural, and if resisted, can be the source of complications. The moment we resist the motion of becoming better, we loose all kinds of sorrows upon ourselves. The child is not punished in nature simply before ignorance. It is presented with means of overcoming ignorance. But if it refuses to accept this information, the child may pass through a series of very trying experiences. Not because anyone hates it, or anyone wants to destroy it, or that God has forgotten it, but because growth is the great reason for existence, whether it is in space, in the family, or in the world. These things are part of a great unfolding order of life. And this unfolding order of life is the thing that is important. Now, when the scientist says we should forget all about history and forget all about the past, he deprives us of a great textbook of experiences and their consequences. There isn't a single problem that we face today, except possibly nuclear physics, and even that is questionable, that has not already been faced. We know very much what happens to nations that drift away. We know what happens when a society loses its ethics. We see the ruins of the past, and in every case, these ruins stand for the misuse of power. Generally speaking, every nation has gone down to disaster, like every individual, through selfishness, through lack of self-discipline, and for ambition to power or wealth. They've all gone down from that cause. So we very carefully avoid mentioning that cause, because it would interfere with the prosperity of the hour and might tempt us to improve ourselves. If this temptation became strong enough, we might become a comparatively intelligent race. And that, in turn, would be a great distress to those who want to exploit us. But these things are not God punishing us. They are the laws of life, the simple principles of integrity asserting themselves over the various ambitions and vicissitudes of human nature. Therefore, we live in a reasonable world. We live in a world in which all things are growing. We are reliving in a world in which cooperation is inevitably necessary, but we are still struggling desperately to maintain competition. We are definitely in need of one religion, but we are afraid we might get it. And instead of working towards it, we do everything possible to keep the barriers up to cause various denominational intrigues and ambitions. Everything that would tend to solve things, we are afraid of. And yet we have to face these things that are right. And the power of destiny, as it was known to the ancients, is the power that says this is going to happen. No matter what we do, we are going to grow. And if we grow the easy way, we can have pleasant gardens and a pleasant life. If we decide to grow the hard way, we will have war and strikes and conflicts and plagues and various inquisitions, as long as we resist the natural law of life. In other words, what we call our environment today is our school. A great moving mass of life with a certain specific destiny, humanity, an entity in space, a collective. Well, we have human collectives, then we have another collective, the animal collective. We have these units, our vast entities, representing laws of living and levels of existence unfolding in one magnificent environment. And this environment is suitable to protect them all, fulfill them all, and bring them all to the perfection of their purposes. That stands between, which is ego selfishness, which is a desire to compete for power, when there can be only one power, and that one power is never on the side of exploitation. The one power to be one is real. Anything to divide this, break it down, and make difficulties for it is illusion. So now we can clear the purposes of life and realize that the universe is not run by despots. It is not run by deities that cast off suns in front and moons behind. It is a great integration of unknown origin, but of absolute honesty and perfect intelligence and infinite love. These things are the great realities, and these are the things that were predestined and foreordained before the beginning of the world. And the only way we can get out of our present difficulty is to begin to move as a unit in the direction for which we were intended to move. Now, because humanity is made up of many different groups, we also have a series of subdivisions within the great structure of humanity. We have racial subdivisions. We have various types of psychological differences. We have religions as units. We have all kinds of unities within the one great unit. And all of these unities within the one are compatible. And until we find they're compatible, we're in trouble. We're going to be in trouble just as long as we fight each other on any ground. Because actually, whether we know it or not, the one that fights and the one who is fought is part of the one that never wants to fight or never wants to be fought. In other words, we can afflict no one but one of our own kind. We can affect nothing detrimental except by injuring the great unity of ourself, this unity of the human being. And we have got yet to learn the idea, the real principle of the brotherhood of man. We have to realize that the great power behind things, it wants this civilization, this culture, this great world order to succeed. It must succeed because there's no such a thing as a failure in the divine plan. It cannot fail. By the very nature of itself, it cannot fail because it is infallible by substance, by essence, and by reality. So we can fight with it for a long time. We can oppose it for ages. We can put down 10, 20, 50,000 years of war and pillage, but has no bearing upon the essential fact that it must end regardless of how we realize or how we think. First is the realization of the brotherhood of man, and secondly, the realization of the identity of all that lives. These principles could become a solution to the constant pressures of our day. Now then, when we go a little further into this matter, we begin to study the various effects of life upon these points. Now, finally, if we consider this vast unity as one, which it is, the Adam Kadmon, the one that is made out of the stardust, then the other mind, a small one, the physical Adam, so-called, Adam meaning in Hebrew a species or a kind, not a person, then we have the problem of this little Adam. And this little Adam is ourselves. This little Adam is each human being, because each human being is a galaxy. Within our skins and in the various structures of our body are as many worlds, planets, and mysteries as ever anywhere in space. We have an inner space that is filled with life, just as the space in which we live. This space lives in us as we live in it. This space, which is ourselves, consequently represents a pattern that we must all follow. In order to fulfill the purpose of our personal lives, we must make sure that this space is maintained properly. We must be certain that we do not betray or falsify this space content in ourselves. We must become good and faithful overseers of this mystery of the body. And in the story of the biblical history, we find that the ego, or the self, becomes, in a sense, the custodian of the body and the custodian of the laws of living. So we can go as we wish in this problem. We can become good and faithful servants, keeping the laws of health to the best of our ability. We can keep the laws of mental and emotional health to prevent psychotic conditions arising within our nature. But where we lack discipline, or where we permit details to take over, where we permit a grudge to become a dominant in our lives, we begin to reap the sorrows that the nations have when they have grudges and wars. For every inclemency of our own body becomes symbolical of one of the larger inclemencies of the world in which we live. So we have a very interesting problem here to think about, namely that we are a unit of life moving through infinite space. We are a unit of life composed of a vast mass of units. Now, we notice something that's very interesting about this. We assume that the real purpose behind this all is growth or unfoldment. Now, considering the human life wave as a unit, we then consider how many entities are in this life wave. Why, how many souls or beings are coming in and going out to constantly keep alive the great forward motion of the entire. And the various questions have been asked on this, and perhaps we can use the Hindu answer as well as any other, because it's at least it gives an idea of magnitude. Their theory is that the human life wave consists of approximately 60 billion entities. That is the life wave to which we belong. Now, obviously, these entities are in a constant process of coming in and going out. They are in here all the time, only a fraction. The same might be true of the problem of the unity of humanity as we know it. There are human beings born every moment. There are human beings passing out of life every moment. But humanity moves forward steadily, gradually increasing in number. The population of the planet on which we live, the human population, 2,000 years ago, was less than 200 million for the whole planet. Up to after that time, it began to increase. Now, does this increase represent more entities? No. It merely represents more of the great cycle coming into embodiment at one time. If the 60 billion are sitting there, or are lying in suspension, awaiting embodiment, those who come in become like children, are born in and can go to school. After a certain length of time, they grow older and pass on. In each generation, a few more come in. Through the progress and growth of life on Earth, more and more human beings come in. Until now, we have altogether somewhat near probably 6 billion human beings. Up from 200,000 to 6 billion. Now, this doesn't mean that there is one single new soul in the world. It doesn't mean that there is one iota of difference in the plan. It simply means that gradually, vehicles for the manifestation of human entities are improving, growing, unfolding, and making possible more to come in and take the lessons of life with us. Little by little, we have built it up, and we'll probably build it up more and more. If we reach a population of 10 billion, then one sixtieth of our entity field will be incarnate at one time. This is important because it gradually means that the life wave is moving gradually into objectivity. The life wave is more and more embodied, and embodied is becoming growing more all on time. With every increase in population, therefore, new scholars have come in to go to school. And those are few who have graduated, disappear or vanish away, but they are in no way substantially changed. There is no death in this pattern. There is only a constant changing toward the better. Now, this is a very large concept, and it's a concept that must be given a lot of consideration. But it is also a concept which contains within it space for growth, and it takes away from us forever this fear of eternal damnation, or from the scientific point of view, eternal oblivion. We are growing up as a being in space. There are other beings. There are animal kingdoms. There are plant kingdoms. There are mineral kingdoms. And even minerals grow, although it's sometimes difficult to point it out. Paracelsus described definitely the growth of metals in the rocks. And I have seen one, this alchemist here, a little old gentleman, who had a little tiny gold tree that had grown in a rock and was still growing, although it was depending on a small piece of rock. Everywhere things live, grow, and fulfill something. Every form of life is part of something coming forth to go to school, to go to learn the lessons of immortality, to become perfect as their Father in heaven is perfect. And this whole pattern has in it not one single moment of evil. It has not one moment of selfishness in the pattern. These things are the result of the individual not gaining a proper insight into the problems of the life to which he belongs. So we can say definitely, for a moment at least, that what we call life is a motion of a great wave of entities into manifestation. That these waves of entities are everywhere in space. That we are by no means the only one. That within our own little planet, there are several of these great waves moving at one time, all compatible and all misunderstood, all fought against by the very persons who should be fighting for them. Now, in this particular time, which we're worrying about, we know that the resistance to growth has become greater and greater, and the errors of mortal mind have become more and more difficult. We are rebelling against life, whether we realize it or not. Anything that does not dignify life is against it. Anything that does not help it to grow injures it. Now, all of these things that are good and bad are not tremendous. It is not a great crime or a great sin for any individual to want to be happy. We all want to be happy. But we haven't found out yet that happiness lies in the keeping of the rules rather than the desperate effort to escape them. We have a feeling that if we can get rid of all law and order, we'll be happy. This isn't true. The more we get rid of law and order, the more of lawlessness and disorder we have. So each individual becoming a student, or is this from the old Rosicrucian formula, an abecedarian in the College of the Holy Spirit. That is exactly what we are. The College of the Holy Spirit is the complete environment in which we exist. The matriculation of a great group of entities is an entry of a group of entities into a great educational cultural system that is completely idealistic, that is completely real, and which will only may be perfected when human beings keep the rules. Now, there are deities of ancient times who were the deities of rules and laws. There were deities of wisdom and truth and help. But all of these deities are symbols of rules. The god of health is the symbol of the individual who lives according to the laws of health. Everything that goes as it should does so because of its order and because of its reality and because of its integrity. These things we have to face, and we like to think of ourselves as perhaps a vast ship upon a sea of infinity. And on this ship, like Noah's Ark, are all the living creatures of the world, all on the great journey from here to there, which in reality is from ignorance to wisdom.